Welcome to the Natural Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Whitfield Cook. Join us as we interview expert clinicians, researchers, and well-being experts from around the world and explore the evidence and application of complementary medicine in global healthcare. The following podcast is intended as professional information for integrative practitioners and as such must not be taken as medical advice. Patients are expressly directed to seek appropriate care from a suitably qualified practitioner. Hi everyone, thanks so much for joining us again. Joining us today is Rebecca Hughes. Again, and she's a naturopath and functional medicine practitioner. And today we'll be discussing a functional medicine approach to managing eczema or atopic dermatitis. Welcome back to Natural Medicine Podcast, Rebecca. How are you?
Thank you. I'm really grateful to have the opportunity to be here again and to share what I've been learning with other healthcare practitioners.
Well, I've got to say, thank you for joining us because I am always delighted by how you indeed share your vast knowledge, but how you approach clinic with a great degree of responsibility to your patients and a great degree of care. And I'm very impressed with how you practice. Well done. So firstly, skin disorders. A lot of practitioners are wary of skin disorders. And I think there's a lot of them that we don't feel totally confident in. What are some key strategies, if you like, that you can share with dealing with skin disorders?
Well, I guess what I've been working on over time, and if we kind of narrow it to atopic dermatitis, is that first of all, to have confidence in your own assessment of the situation. So often patients have been, before they reach a naturopath or a functional medicine practitioner, they have been to at least one, if not multiple dermatologists, and certainly multiple general practitioners as well. And I think that the reason for that also is because these people are in a really strong place of desperation. You know, they're highly, highly uncomfortable. Their skin condition is impacting the quality of their life in multiple ways. And so they do go about seeking lots of opinions from different healthcare providers, and then they get multiple opinions and then they get very confused. And then sometimes they'll walk through the door with a very specific diagnosis from a dermatologist who, you know, I appreciate that they have expertise in assessing skin conditions, and I don't want this to sound arrogant, but I think that I have seen patients who have a misdiagnosis where it's not the diagnosis that they were given. You know, for example, in fact, what they actually show are all the clinical signs and hallmarks of psoriasis, not atopic dermatitis. And guttate psoriasis and eczema can certainly be confused for one another. Mm. And I guess from a functional medicine perspective, because I'm ultimately concerned with the drivers for the immune system imbalance, even whether it is psoriasis or eczema, I'm treating the presentation and the drivers. So the diagnostic label isn't always that critical. But I think when you're looking at autoimmune versus atopy, it's certainly important to think from there, because then it's like, well, what are the other factors that you take into consideration when you're looking at someone with autoimmune risk factors versus atopic risk factors, and the volatility of the condition as well? So atopic dermatitis is highly volatile, highly reactive, versus psoriatic rashes, not as much. Guttate psoriasis is a little bit of an exception in that it can be much more reactive. But usually what you'll see is a lot more chronicity, for example, with guttate psoriasis versus eczema, where you'll see periods of remission and periods of aggravation. And that does inform treatment as well. It informs diagnostic assessments. It informs, you know, the kinds of blood tests that you might do in someone who has more of an autoimmune type presentation versus an atopic presentation. And you know, it's also that I'm sounding like it's either at the moment, but we both know that with the research that's been done on T regulator cells, that in actual fact, people can present with both types of immune dysregulation at exactly the same time. They can have atopic conditions as well as autoimmune conditions. And primarily what my treatment strategies are about is regulating that immune response. And that is also, I think, something that has to be done with addressing multiple systems in parallel. So I think sometimes there's this notion, and I guess we're taught this in at school, is treat the gut first. Or great, you know, like it's very, very important to treat the digestive system. You want to know that detoxification is happening adequately. You want to know that that the small intestine barrier is tight, you know, that it's not leaky. That's important stuff to know. But at the same time, you do have to be addressing the immune dysregulation. You do have to be addressing the nervous system. You do have to be addressing sleep disturbance, because that's when the body heals itself. And then trying to identify in that person's life, what are all of the drivers and triggers, and how can you reduce the total load, rather than focusing or hyper-focusing, for example, on food, which is what happens a lot, both in practice and with the patients themselves. You know, they start to draw connections perhaps where there may not be such strong connections.
Yeah. Well, there's about 20 questions that stem from that comment, but let's start first with differential diagnosis, and then we can go further into treatment and what we do. So how do we differentiate between other common, or indeed some rare, inflammatory skin disorders? And indeed, I've got to ask this question: is eczema classed as an immune-mediated inflammatory disorder, and does it matter?
Well, I think that you'd get a different answer if you asked different kinds of healthcare professionals and different kinds of scientists as well. So I believe that it is an immune-mediated disorder. And also, I guess it depends. Oh, that's a really tricky question to answer. I'm not sure.
It's certainly multifactorial, because there's genetic components, there's environmental components, blah, blah, blah.
And there's sensitization that happens through multiple membranes. So again, we tend as naturopaths especially to focus on gut barrier integrity, but in fact the skin barrier is a way that the immune system can get sensitized in eczema or atopic dermatitis, and it can get sensitized with environmental triggers, you know, like pollens and danders and dusts and even food. Like some of my eczema patients actually have to use gloves to prepare certain foods while their eczema is healing, because they can get sensitized that way. But then there's also the secondary complication of low-grade bacterial infections in sites, whether it be psoriatic or eczema sites. Anywhere where there's broken skin, there's the opportunity for bacteria to enter, and it doesn't necessarily have to look like a highly infected golden staph oozing type of eczema. That's certainly the most acute and serious presentation, but just that angry red constant irritation that can happen in some skin conditions is an indicator that there's bacteria involved. It starts to become involved in the pathophysiology of the disease, because the bacteria starts to break down ceramides. Ceramides are the protective layer in our skin. They form part of the protective layer. And then there's just the inflammatory metabolic byproducts of their own life cycle that starts to contribute to the disease state as well. And that's why things like bleach baths are recommended. And we, you know, it sounds horrific. Like we all balk at the idea of, oh my God, putting bleach on people, but it's obviously it's highly diluted bleach in water. It's designed to control the staph, particularly in atopic dermatitis. But there are other ways that we could do that if practitioners or patients or both don't want to use things like bleach baths. Of course, there's a whole other raft of tools that we have at our disposal. And I feel like I've drifted away from the original question, so please remind me what I'm supposed to be answering.
Well, it was to do with differential diagnosis, but you make an interesting point there about that angriness of a possibly infective nature to the disorder, or an infective component. And certainly if treatment with their orthodox agents, like, for instance, steroids, topical steroids particularly, isn't gaining benefit and is certainly prolonging or worsening the condition, I always suspect an infective nature or an infective component to that disorder.
Yes. And then I think we're talking about differential diagnosis. So there's atopic dermatitis, guttate psoriasis, either of those with a secondary infection. I'd say that dermatitis herpetiformis, although rare, should not be dismissed until all the appropriate testing has been done to dismiss it. And that, for me, looks like genetic testing as well as antigen testing, because some people haven't actually, you know, they've naturally started to exclude gluten in their diet. So doing the antibody testing is going to be fairly inclusive. So yeah, it's useful to find out if you actually have the genetic susceptibility already for developing it. They would be the three main things that I would say often get confused for one another.
Take us through guttate psoriasis presentation. I know we're getting sort of off track, but how do you differentiate?
No. And this is the stuff that I've been developing for myself over time in clinical practice, of the processes to go through. And this is what I share with other practitioners who ask me for mentoring, is that it's not just about the, yes, you've got to assess erythema, itchiness, infiltration, the dryness, the sensitivity and the pain of the skin. I think all those measures are actually also a good indication of what you're dealing with, but also the locations. And I think we've forgotten the bare basics of kind of clinical assessment, is that eczema typically, and I'm not saying everybody is a textbook, but typically eczema occurs on the soft flexural surfaces of the skin. Mm-hmm. And psoriasis occurs on the tough exterior extensor surfaces of the skin. So that's why psoriasis is on the scalp, the back, the tops of the hands, the tops of the feet, the plaques often on the tops of the thighs, versus eczema being in creases and folds and sensitive, really sensitive skin areas. So eczema on the face, eczema in the neck. The neck's a particularly sensitive area. Popliteal fossa, antecubital fossa, abdomen. The abdomen is a place for eczema. In the webbing of the fingers and on the palms is more pomflix eczema. So I think it's really important to look at locations, because that's going to also tell you, even if it's not obvious from the actual the presentation of the rash, then you can start to explore more factors of like where is this rash and where has it been over time in the prominent places.
Just a little question about pomflix eczema. I remember, or I seem to recall, that there was a tie-in for a distal fungal infection. Is that still correct? Is it correct at all, or is there any tie-in?
I'm not really, I don't know about that, but I do know that topically they're certainly likely to get yeast and fungal infections because of the wet presentation, because it goes through a wet and a dry phase.
Yeah.
So certainly that's an important, it's an important thing to consider when it's in the wet phase, that the patient may need to use, they may need to use natural things, they may need to use pharmaceutical products like topical antifungals just to control for that as a secondary type of infection. So again, that's, you know, going back to managing other drivers, and I'd say microbes are definitely a driver in skin conditions, because our skin is basically like, it's the membrane between us and the world.
Yeah, that's right. When do patients seek your care? Do you get most of them that are just finally, you know, the straw that's broken the camel back and they've finally come to see you? Or do you get some that come to visit you early on and ask for help because of the way that they perceive their journey with orthodox medicine?
Mostly I would say that it's after they've seen, I would say 90% of cases they've been to see, like I said, at least one doctor, at least one dermatologist, but usually multiple doctors, and sometimes immunologists, allergists. They've seen the whole
raft. So further down.
And then, so I really wish that it wasn't that case. I really wish patients would come and see people, you know, naturopaths, people like me, before that. Mm. But I understand that we may not be the profession that first leaps to mind about dealing with it. That's the unfortunate thing. But I really haven't noticed a lot of novel techniques or evolution in regular medical management happening for atopic dermatitis. It still appears to be various percentages of steroids,
emollients,
maybe tacrolimus is like a newer substance that's being used, but that can't be used ongoingly because it's associated with risk factors. And then injectable biological medications are certainly being clinically trialed and used more clinically to control eczema, but then they also come with their own risk factors around immunosuppression, as we know. And for me, that is quite a considerable consideration in terms of taking something that suppresses the immune system versus retraining the immune system of how it ought to behave.
Yeah, I'm particularly cautious of the monoclonal antibodies, the immunological agents. When you've got an autoimmune presentation, it can flip. I understand that there's, and I'm being very oversimplistic here, but, you know, if you break down the sort of immune ramper-uppers rather than the immune suppressors, you know, I get they're different agents, but I just have this real caution in the back of my mind when I see a mAb used with somebody who has a predisposition for autoimmunity.
Yeah.
Rings alarm bells in my head.
Yeah, I understand. And especially with the patient group with atopic dermatitis, is that they tend to be a younger patient group as well. And, you know, from children to teens to young adults, of course, there are still adults dealing with chronic atopic dermatitis, but they do tend to be a younger cohort. And I certainly, I'd feel very cautious about prescribing medications like that to younger people, especially because it's those medications are prescribed in the long term. They're like a something, you know, for years, if not the rest of your life.
Yeah. So let's go into natural treatments. What do you employ? Where do you start? How important do you indeed consider the gut, as we mentioned before?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think what the system that I've been developing is around looking at, you know, considering the multiple drivers, and food is certainly a driver because it's antigenic, right? And it's a way to prime the immune system is through food. You can look at there aren't very many validated techniques beyond, you know, you can test IgE and IgG, and you know, there is no perfect allergy test.
No.
For example, you know, you'll see patients who've been tested over time by doctors and other types of practitioners, and they come out with conflicting information, and that's normal. I've come to realize over time that that's completely normal, and that there's no definitive test, and you have to also consider that each test is happening at a point in time.
Mm.
It's not just, unless it's anaphylaxis, in which you can say it's predictably going to be that way for a long time, everything else is open for discussion. And then there's all the other, the whole raft of other food intolerances that you have to use clinical skills to determine, which are their capacity for digesting high histamine and amine forming foods, their capacity for dealing with salicylate, amine, glutamine foods. Do they have a latex allergy, in which case should they be reducing latex containing foods? And then even much more like around the edges, marginal stuff, because it's much more rare, but things like FPIs, which is more associated with things like esophageal, eosinophilic esophagitis and some gut disorders in kids. But that's like that's a really unusual, like it's a delayed hypersensitivity reaction that happens about 4 hours after exposure to the food. Some of those patients do have skin manifestations, although I'd have to say mostly it's digestive. So you've got all these possible things that it could be, and there's nothing precluding multiple food reactions happening at the same time in the same patient. So you've got to be able to assess for that. That's a big thing, because most people eat three times a day. And then looking at, gut permeability, that absolutely, I use lactulose mannitol testing as the way that I do that to assess. And because it's an easy test, you can also do it in kids because it's urine.
Yeah.
You can repeat the test quite affordably to know if your treatment is working. And then using stuff that's going to modulate the immune system. And I think you've got to be cautious about the types of agents that you use for that, because just like foods have antigenic potential, herbs have antigenic potential. And then herbs in alcohol, I almost never use in patients with eczema, because they've already got intestinal permeability. So then it becomes quite tricky, you know, like you've got to try and find formulas that are going to work for your patients that aren't ethanol based and that are still going to have an effect. And so I tend to use more nutrients to start with, because atopic dermatitis is a highly reactive condition. And this is something that I've developed over time, you know, like the process and the protocols that I've developed over time is through all of the different patients that I've seen and the aggravations that I've caused in some of my patients through the types of treatments that I was taught to use.
That's a really interesting point you make about liquid herbs, the ethanol extracts. I know it's been mentioned before, but I've never really given it any import, thinking that we dilute the herbs in water. Hopefully, I'm not one of those. I normally scull them, but anyway, that we normally dilute the herbs in water. And so therefore, I assumed that the alcohol was going to be far less of an issue in causing intestinal permeability. But I totally take your point that these people have already compromised brush border or gut border integrity. So yeah, you're sort of treading glass there, aren't you?
Plus the histamine forming nature of ethanol itself. So you've got gut permeability considerations, plus if you're dealing with, and most eczema patients are already dealing with some kind of histaminosis at some degree. And so you want to minimize all of the factors. And this is where I talk about the total load on the body. It's not that any one particular driver is uniquely responsible and that's very, we do this as humans, right? In terms of we like to think very linearly and go, oh, I ate this thing and then I started itching. It could be that that thing that you ate was just the drop, the last drop in the bucket that caused the bucket to overflow. And so I've constantly got my mind on how can we reduce the overall stress and load on this particular body, like, you know, the person who's in front of me, because everyone's got different lifestyles.
Yeah. So FPIs, the food protein induced reactions, what sort of foods do we have to be cautious of here? Is it any cooking that we have to be extra aware of, extra cautious of?
I'm definitely not an expert in FPIs, and that has to be usually assessed by pediatricians.
Gotcha.
And the food challenges, yeah. I believe FPIs should be done and managed by out of children's hospitals, because that's where,
by a dietitian, so
that's generally when it's identified. But I was just highlighting that even though it's rare, it's a consideration. Like, it's much further down the differential diagnostic list. But I just feel like the overall sort of, there's like a blasé attitude toward treating people with eczema. You know, they're treated as if it's just eczema. It's just a superficial condition. And in actual fact, it's a very complex condition. It's a very debilitating condition. And I know that my patients are really seeking help. And I also know that other practitioners want to feel more confident in that space. And I don't think it's any more complicated than being a specialist in gut health or a specialist in fertility or a specialist in in hormones. I just think it's all about experience and definitely applying the first principles of what we already know as practitioners. But I think it does help to get some, you know, like, for example, I would go and get mentoring from someone else if I wanted to go and specialize in fertility, because yes, I know that I don't have the clinical miles on the board to do that with in a complex situation, with a straight up kind of situation. Yeah, for sure. But I would go to someone else, you know, if I really wanted to make that my niche and I wasn't feeling confident in that area. But I honestly think any practitioners can do this confidently.
I've got to say, I totally agree with you. We should be relying on experts to chaperone us through at least the beginning stages until you can start to at least use your training wheels and then gain, you know, competency and therefore and thence expertise from there. Rebecca, because we're pushed for time today, can I ask you, would you be amenable to come back and we'll go a little bit deeper into, you know, treatments and expected recovery, perhaps any pitfalls and things like that? I do want to cover off a little bit now, but we have a hard stop on our podcast, unfortunately.
Yeah.
All right. Absolutely. So can I just glean from you then treatments? Let's say, you know, that like some of the first things you do, some of your favorite things that you use that tend to be accepted or useful in many or most cases.
I use, you know, after I've done testing, I use glutamine, zinc, vitamin A, vitamin D, simply because they're all very well tolerated nutrients that they have great immune modulating effects. Mm. Yep. And they don't have a lot of antigenic potential. They would be the main things that I start out with. And then
Can we get some doses at all? Glutamine, do you go straight up to, you know, the 10, 15, 20 gram doses, or do you tend to ease on adults, up?
I'll talk about adult doses because then, you know, the kids we know is weight dependent. I'll probably do anywhere between 4 and 10 grams to start with. If the person has some, if it's been obvious that they've had really compromised barrier integrity for years and years and years, I might go up to those higher doses because particularly if the eczema is bad on the face, because there's kind of an association between filigran gene mutations and really severe facial eczema, because not everybody gets facial eczema. It's not that common, like the eczema on the eyelids and the face in adults. It's certainly common in children, but it's not that common in adults. And I'd say that, so those really much higher doses of glutamine are good in those cases. Zinc, anywhere between 25 and 50 grams is a normal dose of zinc.
Milligrams,
yeah. And I will go up as high as 80 milligrams of zinc if it's well tolerated. It's just all about that nausea-inducing, you know, risk with some people with zinc. And vitamin A, I suppose, from about 2,500 up to 10,000 international units. Obviously, there's fertility, you know, you have to explain all that stuff to females who might be fertile about the risks of high doses of vitamin A. Mm. What else did I talk about? And vitamin D. Oh, vitamin D, I get pretty cavalier with. Like, I usually start at 5,000 in adults, and I will go higher if I need to. And depending on test results as well. But I just figure, I guess where I operate from is that these people are in a compromised state, and there's no, and some of them are highly compromised. And so I don't think from RDIs or minimal amounts, because they also want to get better as quickly as possible. And
sorry to interrupt, Rebecca, just for everybody out there, vitamin A, there's an international vitamin A working group paper, which states a pregnant woman, not that I'm advocating this, but just to make a point about safety, a pregnant woman can take up to 10,000 IU of vitamin A, that's IU, not retinol equivalents, at any stage of pregnancy, regardless of vitamin A status. There's some data showing 15,000 protecting against cleft palates. Vitamin D, Reinhold Veith states anything less than, there's no evidence of harm under 10,000 IU. Michael Kimlin from QUT put out a more recent paper saying he sort of errs on the side of caution, saying 7,000, but you're well below that. And that's long-term, that's chronic, not short-term toxicity. So you're well within your safety margins, well within your safety margins. Rebecca, I'm really sorry, but I would love to get you back. I'd love to delve further into this because there's so much exciting stuff that we can learn from you. Would you be amenable to join us back for a part two on this at all?
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you so much. And I'm so apologetic to everybody today, just that I've got a hard stop because I'm really pushed for time. Thank you so much, Rebecca. Like, it's so clear that you care. You really care about your patients and how they will fare from your treatments, not just now, but obviously into the future. Mm. You're so impressive. Thank you so much for taking us through just the beginning that we're going to learn from you with regards to atopic dermatitis and indeed, hopefully, in the future with other skin conditions as well. Thanks so much for joining us on Natural Medicine Podcast.
My pleasure.
And everyone, we're going to put as much information, references, hints and tips up on the show notes. Rebecca, thank you so much for joining us. I really look forward to part two and indeed part 3, 4, 5, 6, and 10.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us today. Bye.